There was a farm that grew some food, the prettiest food they ever did see. Well, the green grass grew all around, and the green grass grew all around. And from this food...
That's the audio from a commercial for Whole Foods Market. Do you shop at Whole Foods or a similar store? Can you tell us why? Not every town has a Whole Foods grocery store, but you have more Whole Foods selections, health foods, natural foods than ever before. And we are going to talk about how and why that's happened this hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back in the 60s, natural foods were a fringe idea, mostly confined to the bulk bins in tiny health food stores. It was mainly the hippies who shopped at the Mifflin Street Co-op here in Madison. In the decades since, sales and the number of products available have skyrocketed, and natural foods are now found on supermarket shelves nationwide. We are going to talk with an author and a former Whole Foods marketing executive about the successful rise of natural foods companies, and welcome your questions and welcome your thoughts on this. Do you seek out natural or organic foods at the grocery store? Why do you do that? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is Joe Dobrow, marketer, management scholar, historian, and journalist who has worked as the head of marketing of natural food retailers that include Whole Foods Market, Fresh Fields, and Sprouts Farmers Market. He is the author of the new book, Natural Profits, From Health Foods to Whole Foods, How the Pioneers of the Industry Changed the Way We Eat and Reshaped American Business. Good morning. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, good morning, Joy. Thank you very much for having me on. And that's a nice introduction. I guess the only thing that I didn't do was actually play the banjo on that commercial for Whole Foods there.
Hey, that commercial made me want to go to Whole Foods. So I guess what we were hearing that song about green grass growing round and round and all sorts of natural and beautiful things and seeing people picking the crops and putting them on the shelves at Whole Markets, Whole Food Markets. Tell us a little bit about that. That's a part of the marketing of Whole Foods.
Yeah, and I would say it's probably a little bit of the mythical marketing that goes along with Whole Foods. If you look back at the history of this industry, as I do in this book, in Natural Profits, it wasn't all that long ago when all of the foods that we ate were natural and organic. It's just we didn't call them that.
Yeah.
There weren't labeling laws. There weren't the sort of regulations that we have in place today. But certainly, if you could peer into the cupboard of our grandparents, that's what you would find. They were eating much less processed food. There were not the sorts of additives and synthetic pesticides and herbicides and fungicides that we see in the food stream today. And it all changed very dramatically and very quickly right after World War II. And what I talk about in Natural Profits is how a group of idealists and visionaries in the 60s and in the 70s began to reclaim that legacy and realized what had happened. It was kind of an emperor's new clothes situation. And among those were the folks who started Whole Foods Market.
Mm-hmm.
And it was started with the best of intentions, really just to try to offer cleaner, more natural, organic foods to the people in Austin, Texas. But we can look at it now today, a mere 34 years later, and see that it's become a huge enterprise. It's number 232 on the Fortune 500 list. So it's a really dramatic transformation in this industry.
Yeah, well, is there something wrong with that?
No, I think it's wonderful. I'm the sort of person, I'm sure many of your listeners are as well, who, given the choice, would certainly rather eat natural and organic. I happen to think they taste better. The jury is out as to whether they're nutritionally superior or not, but certainly there's no argument to be made that it's not better for the planet, it's not better for the farm workers, and for many, many reasons, that's the lifestyle that I've chosen, that many of us choose nowadays. So the fact that these enterprises and these brands had to struggle so mightily against big food and big agriculture and government laws to be able to establish legitimacy and ultimately reclaim that legacy is testament to how far we've come right now. So the fact that you've got Whole Foods as a, gosh, I don't know, a $12 billion company right now, I don't think should be looked at askance at all. I think it's a wonderful thing.
You said that this started with the best of intentions. What were those intentions?
Well, quite simply, it was to save the world. And that sounds kind of highfalutin, but again, if you transport yourself back and think about what the world was like coming out of the Second World War, we had had this huge military machine which had created all of the war material and the ammunition and the weaponry that was needed to win the war. And then the war ended, and we had to somehow convert that productivity to something else. And the primary thing that it was converted to was agricultural use. So in the years immediately after the war, we started to see a surfeit of all kinds of new chemical compounds, the whole new food industry, creating synthetic additives, and what we now call food science was born. And so in a heartbeat, evolutionarily speaking, we saw the world go from this natural and organic life into one in which nearly everything was somehow tainted with chemicals. So when people like Mo Siegel from Celestial Seasonings, or John Mackey, the co-founder of Whole Foods, or Gary Hirschberg, who started Stonyfield Farm, or right there in Wisconsin, George Seaman, who was the founder of Organic Valley,
mm-hmm.
The crop co-op. When these guys started to come of age, you know, they had been born in the early years of the baby boom after the war. They were children of the 60s. They were rejecting materialism. They were rejecting big industry. And when they looked at food, they realized, my gosh, we've sort of had this world pulled out from under our feet. And all of a sudden, these big multinational companies have created a world in which they control what we're eating. So these guys felt, we've got to get out there and change that. We've got to save the world.
Yeah, so how did our food system have to change in order for these natural foods to thrive?
Well, look at agriculture to begin with. We often look back at the salad green industry as kind of a surrogate for what was happening in the overall food industry. Iceberg lettuce, aptly named because it really tastes like water,
mm-hmm.
But iceberg lettuce became the most common vegetable in the United States after World War II because these new pesticides and herbicides started to create the conditions that made the growing of lettuce like that very, very easy. And you had all kinds of new transportation systems and high-speed highway system put in place. And so all of a sudden you had accessibility to products like that. Now, what was unseen by the consumers at that point was how much was actually going on at the farm level. We had added, since World War II, over 80,000 new chemical compounds. And this included things like DDT, which was the most commonly used pesticide in the world after the Second World War, an herbicide called 2,4-D, which is now coming back into use, and many, many, many other compounds, which truthfully increased farm productivity beyond all mathematical reason. So in many ways, that was a great thing for farmers. And if you look at the amount of disposable income that Americans were spending on food, as they do in natural profits, it declined precipitously. So, again, sort of a good thing in that people were able to afford much more food and ultimately better food and other lifestyle accoutrements. However, it came at a cost, and that cost started to become clear in the late 50s and the early 60s when we started to have some food scares. There was a food scare in the late 50s when cranberries that had been tainted with various chemicals were recalled by the FDA, the first time something like that had ever happened. And then Silent Spring came out in 1962 and began to shine the light on what had happened in agriculture and the effects that things like DDT were having on wildlife and on people and on the land. And on through the 60s, one health scare after another. So that's really where the problem became most apparent. Now, there were also other things happening in the laboratories, which I find fascinating. There's a story that I came upon and I wrote about in the book of a product called Merlinex, sort of this whimsical-sounding product. And it was created by a company called International Multifoods in the 60s, and they called it Instant Anything. It was basically a chemical filler that could take all kinds of protein forms, and so they would use it as fig paste, or they would use it as imitation strawberry filling, or
Yum.
Texturizer in brownies, and all sorts of things. There were no labeling laws that required that something like this be listed, and so consumers had no idea that these wondrous new products that were showing up on the shelves had actually been created in the laboratory.
Yeah, well, I suppose we still see some of that going on today, too. But, you know, speaking of cost, I wanted to ask a little bit before we go too much further. You know, Whole Foods has the nickname Whole Paycheck, and I'm wondering if this natural foods revolution is really only being enjoyed by the upper middle class.
Yeah, it's an excellent question, and I think the answer, not surprisingly, is a nuanced yes and no. If you look at the total amount of sales of natural and organic foods as a function of all food sales, it's still only 5 or 6%. You know, despite all the efforts of Whole Foods and Stonyfield Farm and Pacific Foods and companies like that, still $5 or $6 out of 100 are spent on natural and organic foods. But that has been increasing at a dramatic pace. It is forecast to more than double by the end of this decade. And the growth, interestingly, is coming not from Whole Foods, despite its size and its 370-odd stores. And it's coming not from Sprouts Farmers Market, which is the second largest retailer based largely in the Southwest. But it's coming from the conventional stores. So it's coming mm-hmm. from Kroger. It's coming from Roundy's and Cops and the stores that that most of us are used to. If you look at Kroger, for example, they have a private label brand they call Simple Truth. There's an organic version and there's a natural version. Now, at the beginning of 2012, this brand did not exist. They created it by rolling up some other brands that they had. By the end of 2012, it was already over $1 billion in sales. And last fall, Kroger came out and said that if you could somehow take all of the natural and organic foods at Kroger stores and separate them out into their own company, they would be easily the second largest natural foods retailer in the United States. So you can sort of guess at what the number is there, but, you know, maybe $6, $7, $8 billion worth of food. So are natural and organic foods more expensive? They are still, and that's in many ways not surprising. Because you mentioned the Mifflin Street Co-op or the Willie Street Co-op or places like that. I mean, when you get to these small independent shops like that, they don't have the scale to be able to buy products. They don't have sort of the economic advantages of labor that a big company like a Whole Foods or a Kroger does. And so, sure, they do charge a premium. But as we continue to grow this segment of the industry, the costs continue to come down. I think the good work that the conventional stores like Kroger and even, frankly, Walmart and Target and the club stores are doing is all helping to level the playing field out there.
So, Joe, you talked about the Willie Street Co-op as though you've been there.
You know, I have. Madison is a very unusual place in natural foods history, not just because it's the only town in which Whole Foods ever had its employees organized, but simply because it really has this long, progressive tradition of commerce. So there, I mentioned Organic Valley before as one example. Now they're in Lafarge, but the co-op movement, as rooted in the heritage of Wisconsin, is something that we've seen pop up time and time again on the retail food side. So, you know, with Mifflin and with Willie, and I think I don't know whether that was it Nature's Bakery. Is that still around?
Yeah, I think it is.
You know, these are all co-op models that you guys are used to there, but they're actually much more unusual in the rest of the country.
We need to take a short pause, and then we'll continue. We're talking with Joe Dobrow. He is the author of Natural Profits, From Health Foods to Whole Foods, How the Pioneers of the Industry Changed the Way We Eat and Reshaped American Business. We're talking about the revolution that has occurred in the natural foods industry from back in the 60s when this was more of a fringe idea to now supermarkets nationwide are selling natural foods and organic foods. How has your eating habits, your shopping habits, how have they changed over time? How do you decide what to buy and where to buy it? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Do you seek out natural or organic foods at your grocery store? This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking about the rise of natural foods and welcoming your thoughts and questions for our guest, Joe Dobrow, who is the author of Natural Profits, From Health Foods to Whole Foods, How the Pioneers of the Industry Changed the Way We Eat and Reshaped American Business. And our first caller is Sandra in Racine. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I've been a member of the Outpost Co-op in Milwaukee for many, many years. I actually live in Racine, and now we are trying to get a co-op called Wild Root Market going in Racine, so I'd like to put a plug in for that. Being a co-op, I shop the sales, and I just plan my menus around that. And my purpose is back to the soil and the earth. I get the benefit of healthier foods, I believe. And I'm pretty active for my age and staying healthy. And I just think we need to save the soil for the earth. Yeah. The wheat that's grown today is not like the wheat 50 years ago. You hear all that. And I believe that. You know, we just can't continue to change chemically products that we're going to be eating, ingesting. So,
thank you very much, Sandra. Good luck with your new co-op organizing. Joe, there we go, trying to save the earth.
Yeah, and a tip of the cap to you, Sandra. I mean, I think those are laudable efforts. I know Outpost has been around for a long time. I think it dates back to 1970 or the early 70s. And it's so nice to see that spirit still very much alive. You know, that is the same spirit of feeling that we have to save the world that we saw from these people that I write about in the book.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about how customer demand for natural foods grew over the years.
Yeah, it was a pretty lonely place. In fact, Outpost is a pretty good name for a co-op.
Mm-hmm.
That was the name of the game back in the 60s. There's a great little quotation that I came across from Life magazine, 1962. And they said, "The U.S. farmer now approaches a mastery over nature. He alters nature almost at will, breeding his animals and plants to consumer preference, growing gardens where climate and soil had all but outlawed life, changing the very chemistry of the earth to feed the ravenous roots of his bumper crops." You know, that was the predominant spirit of the era. And so if you think about the people who were starting co-ops back then or who were shopping in these lonely little health food stores with the wood slat floors and the bulk bins and the serve yourself peanut butter and honey and brown rice and turbinado sugar, that was the fringe of society. You know, most people were driving their wood paneled station wagons over to the Piggly Wiggly and loading up three times a week and not thinking about it. So it took years and years for that mass market to develop. By the mid-60s, there were only about 500 health food stores around the country. And Madison may have been a little bit overrepresented in that market because most college towns were. But it wasn't until the 80s, really, that this market began to develop in a big way. And in part, that was because the efforts of some of these people that I've written about in Natural Profits started to come to fruition. And in part, it was also because there were some outside events that instilled a lot of fear into the public. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, so that was those events of like the chemical apple scare and that sort of thing.
Exactly, yeah. So that one that you mentioned, the Alar crisis of 1989, it happened 25 years ago next week. And what had happened was that Alar was a chemical agent that was used to help apples and other fruits ripen and develop finer points on the fruit. And it had been a suspected carcinogen, but nothing had been proven. But the NRDC came out with a report that said that 6,000 school children could be at risk of dying because of their consumption of apple products that were tainted with Alar, and that set the media wheels in motion. So February 26, 1989, 60 Minutes came out, trained its caustic cameras on this issue, and did a report that really stirred the hornet's nest. And a couple of weeks after that, Newsweek, which was still a really big deal back then, came out with a story called The Panic for Organic. And that's what there was. The major school systems in the country started canceling their orders, and parents were dumping applesauce, and there was a rapid, enormous shift over to natural and organic eating at that point. It didn't last, but it was one of those seminal moments when the industry and the country began to change.
Well, what if it didn't last, what finally, took hold?
I think the food had to get better. That's really what it came down to. Because, you know, in marketing world, when I was running marketing for Whole Foods, for example, we would often say that we can create great marketing campaigns, but if the store isn't ready to deliver on that promise, there's no point in running the campaign. And I think that was kind of true of what happened with the Alar crisis or the Cyclamate crisis or some of these others, that nobody was expecting these things to happen, and all of a sudden they did, and people went rushing over to these quote-unquote health food stores like Whole Foods or Mrs. Gooch's out in California or Bread and Circus in Boston, and stores weren't really ready for them. They didn't have the variety of product. The packaging wasn't all that sophisticated. The produce, the art of organic growing really hadn't been terribly well refined at that point. And so the food had to get better, and the packaging had to get better, and the marketing had to get better. But that did start to happen in the 80s, and it became an extremely competitive and fascinating industry.
Well, let's take another call from Larry in Madison. Hi, Larry.
Yeah, good morning. Well, I've been in the shopping in the natural foods co-op scene since the 70s. And I've seen the transition over the years. What I've noticed is that a lot of the small co-ops and health food stores were based on, like, whole grain, honey, no sugar, no meat, and how they've transitioned over the years to now you go into Whole Foods and you see it's pretty much the things that people were against, white flour, sugar, and a lot of their baked foods. And you can still get bulk foods, that's true, but in the supermarkets, the natural foods aisle, they have all that kind of packaging, you know, the kind of the groovy, hip-looking packaging, and then you look on the ingredients, and they've kind of co-opted the natural foods image to market their products.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Larry. You look back at the early days of the natural food supermarkets, and I mentioned Mrs. Gooch's a moment ago. They were a real trendsetter out there, and they had standards unlike any supermarket that you would see today. So Sandy Gooch had a list of things that she called the unmentionables. She would not stock anything that had caffeine, that had white sugar, that had alcohol, that had white flour, that had irradiated foods, irradiated ingredients, things like that. And there was a saying in the industry back in those days, is it Goochable? Is it a product that could be sold at Mrs. Gooch's? Because if not, you better go and reformulate it. That was the standard that many of the companies used back in that day, including the co-ops and the small health food stores in particular. And you're right, things have changed a lot. When the Organic Foods Production Act was passed in 1990 and ultimately implemented in 2002, it carved out a number of exceptions for the federal definition of what is organic that opened the door for the inclusion of some processes and ingredients that the purists might have rebelled against. And you can argue both sides of that, I think. Many people do argue both sides of that. But there's no question that today we see a very different roster of foods in the natural and health food stores that do look and feel and taste much more like their conventional counterparts. I would say that for my money, I still shop there because, you know, if I'm going to buy a brownie or processed food, I would much rather buy it with all natural ingredients in it, even if one of those happens to be sucanat or some kind of natural sugar, than buying one at a conventional store that's got high fructose corn syrup and artificial sweeteners in it.
I'm still getting laughing because I thought Gary mentioned that the natural food stores or products had groovy labels. But in any case, what makes the... So if I buy a package of white flour at Whole Foods, is that any better than a, you know, package of white flour that I get at the convenience store?
Not if it's the same brand, and in many cases you do see the same brands there. But there's no question that if you buy Bob's Red Mill, you are getting a different product than if you buy a Pillsbury. Mm-hmm. And it differs based on its protein content. It differs based on whether there are elements of the whole grain still in there. So it's still caveat emptor. I think everybody needs to read labels, even though the stores like Whole Foods have made it a lot easier for us not to do that.
So how are we defining, you know, natural foods versus organic foods? Natural doesn't have to be organic, or does it?
No, and that is, again, it's really the question of the hour. You look back through history, and I talk about this a little bit in Natural Profits, there was a time when organic didn't really mean anything. Every state that chose to had its own law. And so you could go into the Outpost Natural Foods co-op in Milwaukee, and you would see on the shelf right next to each other a product that said Pennsylvania organic, California organic, mm-hmm. Colorado organic. And they meant different things. So it was crazy. It was a confusing patchwork quilt that needed to be solved, and ultimately the federal government did that. So that today, if you see something that has the USDA organic seal on it, albeit that there are variations on things that are, you know, organic or made with organic ingredients, and there are different statistics associated with those, but you can feel confident that it is organic. That is not true with natural. Within the industry, we tend to have, I would say, a common definition or a common understanding of what natural is, and it means it's made without any synthetic additives, no flavorings, no sweeteners, no preservatives, and so on and so forth. But there is no law that governs that. And so, to a certain extent, it is a little bit of the Wild West out there. And there is considerable talk within the industry now that perhaps natural is going to be the next focus for efforts to create federal legislation. Once we finally get through the morass of genetically modified GMO, which we haven't talked about, but that's sort of the real hot button labeling issue that's out there right now.
Yeah, and we will get to that, but we have other callers. We have Eugene and Viola with us. Hi, Eugene.
Hi, good morning, Joy. I eat out at the Rokeland. There's a food co-op out at by Rokeland, organic food co-op out there. They haven't been around that many years. But I was talking to him one time, and I asked him what their revenue was. And Brooklyn's got a population of about 4,000. And what they told me was astounding. They said they gross about $6 million a year in that store. And it isn't that big. And their food is good. Yeah. That soup is just good. I get out there about every day, every other day.
And I'm sure, what was the name of this place?
It's the Brooklyn Food Co-op.
Okay. Well, that's right in Organic Valley territory, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. All right, thanks very much. Any comment, Joe?
It was just great to hear. You know, I think the enthusiasm that people show for businesses like this gives me that optimism that 5-6% number that I cited before really will double or triple before too much longer.
We are talking with Joe Dobrow. He is the author of Natural Profits, From Health Foods to Whole Foods, How the Pioneers of the Industry Changed the Way We Eat and Reshaped American Business. And we welcome your questions for him at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We are talking about the rise of the natural food industry, and we're welcoming your thoughts and questions for our guest, Joe Dobrow, who is a marketer, management scholar, historian, and journalist who has worked as the head of marketing for natural food retailers that include Whole Foods Market, Fresh Fields, and Sprouts Farmers Market, and author of the book Natural Profits. Our next caller is Richard in Viroqua. Hi, Richard.
Hi, how's it going?
Very good. So what's your thought or question?
The biggest act of rebellion you can do against the monoculture system that we have today is to buy organic. I'd also like to give a big shout-out to the Viroqua Food Co-op. I go there 2 or 3 times a day. I'm not happy that Monsanto is trying to own life through its production of DNA and its rewriting of the laws. And really, other than picking up arms and attacking them, the only thing I can do is buy organic. It's the best way to give them the finger.
I guess I don't have to bleep that out. Okay. Well, thank you, Richard. He's concerned about Monsanto also because of GMO, so maybe we should talk about that red-hot debate.
Sure. Well, you know, your listeners have gotten the sense right now that what I've tried to do in this book is to create the historical perspective for this industry. And, you know, what fascinated me so much about it, attracted me to work in the industry to begin with, was that we really sort of sensed that we were part of a movement. And in my view, I think the natural and organic foods industry has been highly influential, not just in what we eat and how we talk about food, but on other industries as well. And this GMO issue is part and parcel of that. So 20 years ago, 1994, May 18th to be precise, that was the day that the GMOs officially came into our lives with something that was called the Flavor Saver Tomato. You might remember that whole story. And it was a genetically engineered tomato plant that had genes from the E. coli bacterium implanted in it to try to help it ripen better and remain on the vine a little bit longer.
Oh, Lord, I didn't know that.
Yeah. It was not commercially successful. The fruits didn't taste very good. They were too small. It ultimately had to be crossbred with a conventional tomato. But that lifted the lid on Pandora's box, and then we flung that lid out the window and buried it, and we haven't seen it since. And so since then, the genetic engineering of crops and other foodstuffs has really become very commonplace in the U.S. So that today, I think the numbers are that if you were to analyze all of the major crops out there, over 90% of sugar beets, over 90% of soy, over 85% of corn, all comes from seeds that have been genetically modified. And this year, in fact, I think possibly even next week is the end of the comment period on this, we may see a genetically modified salmon come on the market, the Aqua Advantage fish. We've already used the genes from fish in tomatoes. We've used the genes from human saliva and breast milk in rice. And so, again, you know, there are two sides to every argument, and one argument is that this sort of genetic modification helps to grow crops. In a year like this, where we're having severe drought in the growing regions, there's little doubt that some genetic modification could help farmers and could help crop productivity. But the question that most of us who are part of the natural foods movement ask is, at what cost? You know, do we really understand the long-term health implications of messing around with Mother Nature like that?
Yeah. And a lot of the critics will say, or the pro-GMO people will say, there is no evidence of any health impacts or consequences, so you're just being alarmist about this.
Yeah, and I think there are many arguments that are made against natural and organic foods that are very similar to that. But what the pro-GMO crowd, I guess, would argue is simply that we're not going back. You know, the world has changed too much. All we really want is transparency. Let's understand if our products contain genetically modified ingredients or not, and then let the consumer decide.
Yeah, what do you think is going to happen? I understand that this the labeling debate, we might have some sort of answer on that maybe even this year?
Yeah, I believe that there is labeling legislation that's at least being considered in 26 different states this year. Now, there were two very prominent efforts over the last 2 years in Washington State and in California, both of which went down to defeat, in part because there was a very significant lobbying effort against them. But I also think that consumers just really aren't informed enough about the issue yet. We're getting there.
Yeah. So it's a state-by-state thing. There's no federal effort.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, no, I would not anticipate that there's going to be a federal effort on that, given the history of what we've seen with organic and natural. I think it's going to have to start on a state-by-state level.
Let's go back to the phones and take Michael and Baraboo next. Hi, Michael.
Yes, good morning. Say, this whole natural foods thing has become a huge moneymaker for people who don't deserve to make money on it, and it's very frustrating for my wife and I and our family. Since we've a couple of years back, when we saw that more natural foods were coming on the market, we really strive to try to put natural foods and to avoid a lot of these foods that have all these ingredients, most of which you can't even read or understand, and not have that stuff on our table. But what we did notice right away is that in changing our shopping habits is that many of the things that we used to buy years ago that we're now realizing a lot of stuff in there was not good for us, have now slapped labels on them that say all natural, farm raised, and they've done absolutely nothing to the ingredients that are inside of it, except that including changing the label to make it seem like it's all natural and increasing the price sometimes twice as much from what it used to be. It's crazy that when I'm trying to feed my family good things, that it costs me literally twice as much to buy those things that are good for my family as it does the junk. And a lot of the junk is mislabeled. And to take it a step further, my wife and I went through 20 items that we found, that we photographed the ingredients in the back and said, look, this is the same product years ago that now says all natural on it, that's being sold for more money, and they haven't changed a single thing in their ingredients, and made contact with the FDA, and they said, yeah, that's really locally controlled, and there's nothing we can do about that, but thank you. They sent us this very nice letter saying, thank you for your time, but we know it's a problem, and there's nothing that we can really do about it. Oh. I mean, that's ridiculous.
Michael, can you remember an example of something that was just a cruddy product at one time, and now it's all natural, and they're selling the same product?
There was this sea salt chip thing that we had bought and we were watching it because we thought, oh, it has some of the better ingredients on it and such. And one of the things was like some of these more natural snack products. And so many of those never changed anything in their label, anything inside in the ingredients. They just slapped all natural on it. I mean, I'm sorry I don't have the – I was driving to work thinking, I wish I had that list, because we had a whole list of them, and then we tried to complain to our legislators and tried to complain to FDA, and they're just like, you know, that's all locally controlled. And there's really – they sent us this beautiful two-page letter as to basically saying, yeah, thanks, but no thanks. There's nothing we can really do about that. And it's ridiculous. I should pay so much more for the stuff that's really natural, that's really good for my family, when this kind of nonsense goes on and nobody is doing anything to regulate it.
Are we being misled, Joe?
I don't think we're being misled. I do agree that I think the environment still is too confusing. You know, if you looked at two products side by side, one that was conventional, one that was natural or organic, better yet, organic, common sense would say that the product that has fewer ingredients in it, that went through less processing, should be less expensive. But that's not the case. And part of that comes down to supply and demand. Part of it comes down to just its overall availability. There are companies out there like Pepsi, which owns Frito-Lay, that I think are moving in the right direction. So they made a commitment that they wanted their Frito-Lay division to go all natural. The problem is they started to put that all natural label on some of these products out there. And I think they are making some changes to the product ingredients in there, taking out some of the cheaper stabilizers and things like that, and understanding that if they move enough volume, they really don't need those. So there have been some improvements and modifications there. But, you know, go back to what I said earlier. This the pendulum has swung so dramatically from a world of all natural and organic that our grandparents grew up in to a world in which there was almost nothing natural and organic when we started to come of age. It's going to take a considerable effort to get that pendulum back to the point that we want it.
Now, many organic brands are owned by big food companies such as Kraft and Heinz and Kellogg. Why did these companies invest in natural foods, and how do customers feel about that relationship?
To answer the second question first, I think that many customers are still not aware of those relationships. Mm-hmm. And there are some really fascinating graphs out there on the Internet, charts that show the ownership channels, and it is startling in many ways how many of the natural foods companies are now owned by them. But the story of how that happened I find just fascinating, and that's why I wrote about it in Natural Profits. For the longest time, these big food companies just kind of laughed at the natural food companies. And I tell a great story about Celestial Seasonings, where in its earliest days, the founder, Mo Siegel, goes to a dinner party in Chicago that happens to have the CEO of General Foods there, a guy named C.W. Cook. And Mo tells him that he started this natural tea company out in Boulder, and C.W. Cook says, oh, isn't that nice? You've driven all the way out here. You know, we make a lot of beverages. We make things like Tang that the astronauts take up into space. And someday we're not going to need to do anything other than make foods from laboratories out of chemicals. And Mo starts just getting so mad, and he tells this guy, you know, if you keep talking like that, the natural foods industry is going to explode. And C.W. Cook says to him, why don't you give up your goofy little tea company and come work for me? That was the haughtiness that the big food companies looked at the natural industry with for the longest time. But in the 80s into the 90s, when companies like Whole Foods and Fresh Fields and Bread and Circus started to prove that they could make a lot of money, basically to generate value while they were holding on to their values, the big companies started to look, and they started to copy, and they started to co-opt a lot of it, and then they started to buy into it. And so there was this rush from about 1996 on for big food to buy into natural and organic food. What's interesting to me is that we are now starting to see a new business model And this is, I think, well exemplified by Honest Tea, which is now owned by Coca-Cola, and by Stonyfield Farm, which is owned by Groupe Danone, which makes Danone. Because in both of these cases, although a big food company bought an organic food company, they kept the founder on, they kept the company intact, and the goal of the original organic founders, Seth Goldman of Honest Tea, Gary Hirschberg of Stonyfield Farm, is what we've come to call the reverse DNA model. Their feeling is, if we can do greater good for the world if we utilize the distribution systems and the voice and the budgets and the manufacturing capacity of these big companies while helping to make them more conscientious and better companies from the inside out. And it's a fascinating new business model, but we're starting to see that happen a lot.
Let's take another call from Jamie in Oshkosh. Hi, Jamie.
Hello. Very wonderful topic. The thing that I find most fascinating is being able to actually get my hands on information. I have a wonderful app called FujuCate that I use that when it scans the product, all it does is take a picture of the UPC, and it gives me the information of what natural means, and it says, you know, it's not regulated, and it gives me information of what, you know, these really long, you know, hyphenated words are. And I just want to say, if more people knew of this app, I think more people would be able to understand what's in their products and what you know, making better decisions, because then they have information at their hands.
Oh, so what's the name of it, Jamie?
FujuCate. It's like educate, but food in front of it.
All right, thank you very much.
Yeah, that's an app that I've seen, and I love the idea because, again, it sort of reinforces what we've been trying to do in this industry for a long time, which is to just educate people. You know, that was the marketing plan for the longest time. It was just to tell customers, here's what organic means, here's who the farmers are, here's how they're doing things differently, and here's why we encourage you to buy it. It wasn't about catchy jingles. It wasn't about slick packaging. Now I kind of feel like we finally have turned the corner, and the education levels are out there. The fact that the conventional stores and even a gas station convenience store is selling natural and organic foods is a great thing, but it doesn't mean that the need for education has gone away. And if technology like FujuCate can help, I'm all for that.
We have just a minute or so to go. What do you think lies ahead for the natural food industry?
I do think that we're going to continue to see very strong growth there. The industry made it through the recession in reasonably good shape. We're starting to see more and more acres converted over to organic, which is good. I think we'll get some resolution on this GMO issue at some point, hopefully within the near future. And I think you will continue to see more hybridization from the retail side so that you don't need to rely on a Whole Foods or for that matter, on the co-ops to find these foods, but you should be able to find them everywhere. You know, I've tried to strike a very optimistic note in the book. It's not a political book. It's not a food porn book. It's a business book. And as I look at the business, I really am very encouraged by it.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Joy.
Joe Dobrow is author of Natural Profits, From Health Foods to Whole Foods, How the Pioneers of the Industry Changed the Way We Eat and Reshaped American Business. We have more information about the book, the website, on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Thanks to Christy Taylor and to Bill Martins for producing and directing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you are with us tomorrow. We're going to be talking with NPR's TV critic about race and stereotypes in the media. That's tomorrow at this time. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.